Sarah, good afternoon. Western leaders have been restating their support for Israel after Iran fired more than 300 missiles and drones at the country overnight. Israeli forces say almost all of the projectiles were shot down. Jordanian and American jets helped. RAF jets flying in the area were also given permission to shoot, but it isn't clear if they opened fire. One person was injured in the attack. The barrage was the first time Iran has carried out a direct attack on Israel's territory. It was in response to a deadly strike on an Iranian consulate in Syria. President Biden says America has an ironclad commitment to Israel's security. Rishi Sunak condemned what he called reckless strikes and said Iran was showing once again that it was intent on sowing chaos in its own backyard. The EU called it an unprecedented escalation. Iran says it summoned the UK, French and German ambassadors over what Tehran called the country's irresponsible stance. In other news, details are emerging about the victims of a deadly knife attack at a shopping centre in Sydney yesterday. Six people were killed and 12 were injured. The attacker, Joel Couchy, who is 40 years old, was shot dead by police at the scene. His family says he suffered mental health issues. Police say a 30-year-old security guard named Faris Tahir is among the dead. A 9-month-old girl was also hurt. The child has undergone surgery. The Home Office says 214 people were brought to Dover yesterday on 5 boats. The number of migrants crossing the Channel on small boats is up nearly a fifth so far this year, compared with the same period in 2023. Charities supporting asylum seekers say they'll launch legal challenges as quickly as possible after a new bill to allow the government to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda becomes law. The legislation is expected to clear Parliament in Westminster by the end of the coming week. The government hopes it'll allow flights to take off within the next 10 weeks. Now on to the weather forecast. There'll be one or two showers in North Wales and Northern England through the afternoon. The rain will be more substantial in Northern Ireland and in Western Scotland. It'll be mostly dry and sunny across the south, temperatures peaking at 15 Celsius in London, 13 in Cardiff, 11 degrees in Belfast and 10 degrees in Edinburgh. And that's the BBC News and Weather at 12:02. Now on Radio 3, Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Professor Sue Black is one of the world's leading forensic scientists. She says, "I've never been spooked by the dead. It's the living who terrify me. The dead are much more predictable and cooperative." Her painstaking work and expertise mean she can work out how people have met their end. And police forces, the Foreign Office and the UN have called on her evidence in countless high-profile investigations. She was the lead forensic anthropologist to the British forensic team during the international war crimes investigations in Kosovo and the Thai tsunami victim identification operation. Back in the UK, she provided evidence that helped prosecute Scotland's biggest paedophile ring. She's currently the president of St John's College, Oxford, and in 2021, she entered the House of Lords as a crossbench peer. She's just been appointed to the most ancient and most noble Order of the Thistle, the highest honour in Scotland. Quite an achievement, Sue, one way and another.
It's a bit ridiculous, really, isn't it? But thank you, you're so kind.
No, it's very much deserved. As we'll hear, some of your music selections actually reflect your Scottish heritage. But we're going to start with Handel.
Oh, wonderful. This, for me, is just the epitome of Christmas. My father was an organist and a pianist, and every Christmas he would place Handel's Messiah on. It just became synonymous with Christmas. And I've just carried that on. So for my children, it's become their Christmas as well.
And which particular bit do you love?
Any bit, all aspects of it. But Unto Us a Child is Born usually coincides with when the roast potatoes go in the oven. So that seems to be a pivotal moment for us all.
Unto us a child is born, unto us
There's really something of the bouncing bairn about it, isn't there?
Isn't there just? I'm just about ready to put the parsnips in now. I can smell the potatoes.
For Unto Us a Child is Born, from Handel's Messiah, performed by the English Consort Choir and Orchestra, conducted by John Nelson. You were born in Inverness, and your dad, as well as playing, he was a cabinet maker.
He was a cabinet maker, upholsterer and French polisher. And a good Scottish word, he was a flitter, which means you would move people from one house to another. And he built his own van. And I can remember him telling me the stories about taking his furniture van over the Bialachna Ba, which takes you from Loch Kishorn up to Applecross, which is hairbend, like you would expect in the Swiss Alps. And he remembers at one point coming back down and his father saying to him, "Turn off the lights, boy. We need to save the electricity."
When you were six, your family moved to Strumferry.
We did.
On the west coast.
Mm.
It's a remote part of Scotland. And I wonder what it was like growing up there. Did you relish that or did you miss hubbub?
Oh, no, total freedom. Absolutely total freedom. So first thing in the morning when we were on holiday, you were thrown out the house and you disappeared for the entire day to do as you wished.
What effect do you think that had on you as a person, having that freedom so young?
I think it made me more self-sufficient. My grandmother always said to me, if you're bored, the problem is between your own ears. And I don't remember ever being bored as a child because there was always something to do. And because we ran a hotel on the West Coast, I was also expected to pull my weight there. So I'd be meeting people at the front door and carrying their suitcases upstairs and washing dishes in the kitchen and helping iron the sheets in the laundry.
And talking of self-sufficiency, your dad would go hunting.
Yes. My maiden name was Gunn, which is a good north of East Scotland name. And he was a fantastic shot, so was his father. And I just would take any excuse to be with my father because I just adored him. And so when he went shooting, it was always for the pot. It was never sport. From a very young age of five or so, I can remember carrying home the dead rabbits or the pheasants or whatever he'd shot and just sitting at the back door with him whilst he taught me how to skin a rabbit or grill a deer.
And you got used to dealing with bones and...
Oh, totally. I mean, from a very young age, up to my elbows and blood and guts just seemed perfectly natural. So when I got to school time and all of my friends were working in chemists where they were selling makeup or fashion stores, I got a job in a butcher shop because it seemed the most logical thing to do.
And from bones to pipes, because your dad played the organ in the local church, and he had a particular job for you, didn't he?
He did. He always asked me to go with him every Sunday. You'd move around between different churches. If he had a particularly difficult piece of music, then I would stand beside him to turn the pages. But the rest of the time, he expected me to be in the front row. And my job was when we got to the last verse, I had to place my hand on the pew in front. Now, if I forgot, then I was in trouble because that meant he kept playing and nobody had a verse to sing to. But I did it well most of the time.
I've heard so many wonderful variations on this story. A family member in the front row slamming down the prayer book to let the organist know that they'd reached the end of a verse.
Yeah, just my hand. That was all I was told to do.
This next music reminds you very much of your dad, doesn't it?
Yes, Jeremiah Clarke's Trumpet Voluntary, which was just such a beautiful piece. I used to love sitting and listening to him play. Every Saturday, he would go and practice in the church because he had very big hands, my father, and he needed to limber them up. And I was a young child. I'd get a bit bored every now and again, and he'd notice, and he'd slip from this piece of music into a piece of Glenn Miller, In the Mood. And of course, that would just send me into paroxysms of giggling. And I cannot hear either of those two pieces of music without thinking of the other one.
Thank you. It's a real summons to attention, isn't it?
I can just see him doing that little trill with his fingers, and that's why he used that piece of music, is that it helped him to warm up his great big hands.
Jeremiah Clarke's Trumpet Voluntary, or to give it its full title, The Prince of Denmark's March for keyboard in D major, performed there by Simon Preston. In your book, Sue Black, Written in Bone, Hidden Stories of What We Leave Behind, you describe just how much you can learn from looking at the bones of a person, and say that memories are locked within our skeletons in a kind of music.
I do. I liken it a little bit to putting a stylus on a record, in that sometimes you will just hear a little clip of a tune, and that tune of someone's life. We might not be able to play the entire piece, but we'll get little snippets. And sometimes that's enough, that little snippet of a life, to be able to piece together who the person may have been. Because that's my role. My role is not about how did the person die. My role is about who was that person when they were alive. It's about bringing a name back to a person. And sometimes it's a really challenging thing to do, because if a body is found with no circumstantial evidence, there's no credit card, they're not in a car, they're on a hillside somewhere, badly decomposed and have clearly been there for years, how do you find that little snippets of tune that is their life that we can start to piece it together?
So what kind of clues do we leave behind in our bones?
So the four things that you would look at are the sex of the individual, male or female, what age they were when they died, what height they were, and what was their ethnic origin. But from the bones, it might be previous fractures that you've had, surgery that's left plates and screws. It might be your dentition, or it might just simply be the chemical composition of your bones that will tell us something about where you've been living.
Well, going back to your early life, this next music is a song from then, from Scotland.
It is. Growing up as a child, I had the real pleasure of seeing this duo when they were playing in Inverness. And they really reinvigorated a lot of the old Scottish music. And some of it, of course, when you go back to Jacobean times, was really stirring. Let's get the Highland blood up and boiling, because we've got some English to go and kill.
So what is this about, this song?
So this is called Why Wouldn't Effect for Charlie? And it's about those members of the clans saying, why would you not rise up and fight for Prince Charlie, which of course was Bonnie Prince Charlie.
Charlie, why wouldna draw the sword? Why wouldna up and rally at the royal prince's war? Thinking Scotia's ancient heroes, thinking foreign foes repelled, thinking loyal Bruce and Wallace, qua the produce of Burkwell. Charlie, why wouldna draw the sword? Why wouldna up and rally at the royal prince's war? See the northern clans advance, and see Glengarry and Lochiel. See the brandish broadsword glance, and Highland hearts as through as steel. Charlie, why wouldna draw the sword? Why wouldna up and rally at the royal prince's war?
Now the prince has raised his banner, now triumphant is our cause. Now the Scottish lion rallies, let us strike for prince and laws.
Why wouldna victor Charlie, why wouldna draw the sword? Why wouldna up and rally at the royal prince's war?
Guaranteed to get the blood running.
Doesn't that just put the heather between your toes? And I love the fact that the only instrument there is the baran, the drum that they're playing. All the music comes from the voices. Just, I love that.
Wow, what an effect for Charlie, performed by the Corries and arranged by Ronald Brown and Roy Williamson. You moved back to Inverness Sue Black in 1972, which is where your grandmother lived, and I think you were quite close to her.
I was very close to my grandmother. She was brought up and born in a little place called Glenelg, which is on the west coast. From Glenelg as a young woman, she moved to Inverness and she married my grandfather. But for me, as a child growing up, she was the most worldly wise woman I'd ever met. And she had that innate ability that some people have, irrespective of the age of the person she was talking with, she could be at their age. So she never made you feel like a child. She always made you feel like an equal.
How did you find secondary school?
My first school that I went to was a bit of a shock for me because it was a very, very big school. And I find that hard, but I learnt very early on that the way to get through when you are not a stick insect, so I've never been thin, when you are a redhead and when your surname is Gunn and your initials are SM, which stand for submachine gun, then you learn very quickly that either you need to have thick skin or you need to get a very big boyfriend. So I did both. And so I had a lovely young man as my boyfriend all the way through the first part of secondary school, and he was my minder. And I really didn't want to stay in that school. I found it a very uncomfortable place. There was a lot of bullying. And so I knew that my only way to succeed was to pass some exams. And if you pass the exams, you move to the academy. And when I did, my goodness me, it was just wonderful. So an environment that was predicated almost entirely on academia and success.
Neither of your parents had been to university. So how did you approach the idea of further study after school?
Myself and my friend decided we were going to apply to university, and I didn't tell my parents. So when it came through with an offer at the end of my fifth year, I thought, I'm going to have to break the news to my mother. She cried for the entire 8 weeks before I left and went to university. But I also decided in my wisdom as a 17-year-old that my parents could not afford to put me to university. So I lied to them and I told them I had a full grant, which I didn't have. And so I made sure that I worked three jobs at the same time when I got to university.
Was that Aberdeen?
Yes, it was. It was at Aberdeen. And my first 2 years there, I must admit, I really didn't know what I was there for, because I was really not interested in botany or genetics or zoology or chemistry or soil science. None of them did it for me. And by the end of second year, I had to make a choice. And the two things I was any good at was anatomy, but I'd only been looking at cells in a microscope, and I knew I couldn't do that for the rest of my life, or botany. And I went to see the botanist, and God bless him, but he was the most boring man on the planet. And when I went to the anatomist, she said to me, you will for a whole year dissect a human body from the top of their head to the bottom of their toes, and it will take you a whole year to do. And I thought, that's the butcher shop, isn't it? It's a different animal, but it's a butcher shop. I can do that. And that was why I went into anatomy.
We had some music for your dad, and I think this next piece is probably for your mum.
It is. My mother was also a pianist. She was very good. She wasn't at the same level as my father, but she would certainly sit down and she'd plink away on the keys. But my mother was an inveterate romantic, and she spent her life looking at the films coming out of Hollywood. And she really wanted to be wooed by Stuart Granger or Dean Martin or somebody along those lines, Frank Sinatra. And so she would listen to the crooners and realise that she'd married the wrong man. My father was a typical Scotsman of his time, ex-military, practical, even to the point that every single year he had the same birthday card or Christmas card that he brought out for my mother. So my poor mother only ever got one birthday card from him in her life. He kept bringing it out year after year.
And this piece has all of that romanticism in it.
It does. This is Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. And whilst she would love to hear these sort of strains going through the house, that's the point usually which my father would say, right, I'm off out to the garage. And then he'd come back in, he'd put on classical music or his pipes. And that's the point at which she'd say, right, I'm going out to do the gardening.
Thank you.
Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, at least the opening of it, performed by the Aalborg Symphony Orchestra and Wayne Marshall, who was conducting from the piano.
It's so bright and it's so cheerful, but it's also got such a depth and meaning as well. I can just see my mother wanting to think about the Hollywood musicals in that. Beautiful piece.
Well, a lot of the music you've chosen is extremely cheerful, isn't it? Do you think that's probably a little antidote to your work?
Some of the funniest places I've been in the world are mortuaries. And I know that feels totally counterintuitive, but sometimes I think the job that we do is so awful that you have to have those moments of black humour to see you through.
Gallows humour.
It is, but it's never directed at the deceased. It's never directed at the situation. It's usually at each other. So we'll play practical jokes in each other. But it's also the fact that I think when you confront death on a daily basis, you get a perspective that says you've got to live every single moment as it comes. So I find that on large, most people who work in mortuaries are really happy people.
And I think you feel very strongly that people that donate their bodies for dissection are doing an incredibly valuable service.
It's amazing. So I think it's one of the most selfless gifts, that whilst you're alive, you make the decision to sign a piece of paper that says, when I die, my mortal remains are handed over to an anatomy department. And the only thing that's asked is that we learn their body for you to learn, and no other reason. It's humbling, it really is. And the first moment I walked into a dissecting room and I saw the 50 tables all covered with white sheets and a body underneath there, so that education, learning and advancement could occur as a result of their death, I think that's incredible.
Did you find your first experience of actually seeing a dead body unsettling?
Interesting question. So walking into the dissecting room was hard. And then once you'd crossed that Rubicon and you were in the room, you knew you had a job to do. Then the white sheet had to come off and you were confronted with the body. And that's a sobering moment. But the real Rubicon is when you have to place a scalpel blade onto the handle and you have to cut through human skin. That was a real moment where you think, how am I going to feel? And you're very nervous, very, very nervous. And the one thing we'd always said is, if you look down at the body and there's blood, it's not the cadaver that's bleeding, it's you. And usually we would cut our finger the very first time we put a scalpel blade on, because we were careless. And it reminded you that there is a difference between you and the body, one alive, one dead, one to teach, one to learn. And when you've cut through that skin and you've peeled it back, then you're into an entirely different world. Once you've made that first cut, it is the hardest.
You were married and had a daughter and then moved to London for your first teaching role as a lecturer in anatomy at St Thomas's Hospital. This was when the police began to come to your department, not to arrest you, but for advice.
Well, it first came about when there was an individual missing. The theory was that the individual had been murdered, the body cut into many number of pieces and dumped in various bins around the city. So the police were out excavating a landfill site. Now, you can imagine you're going to find all sorts of things in there, perhaps human, but you're going to find dead dogs and cats and the remnants of people's Sunday lunches and takeaways. So the girl in anatomy got called down to the mortuary. And I can remember the very first police sergeant I worked with. He was a miserable so-and-so, he really was. And he sort of looked me up and down, and you could see that he thought, what does she know? She's just a slip of the girl. And I think that's where my time in the butcher shop, working with the public, taught me a way to communicate. So I took the bone that he brought and I popped it in a plastic bag, sat it on top of the radiator and chatted a little bit longer. And then when it was sufficiently warm, I opened up the bag and I popped it under his nose and said, what can you smell? And he said, well, that smells like roast lamb. I said, exactly, it's a sheep. It's not a human bone, it's sheep. And he was so impressed that he had solved it, that he thought, oh, the girl wasn't that bad. And so I got called down every single time they found a bit of something in that landfill, but we never found the individual we were looking for.
We should probably turn our mind, Sue Black, now, to nobler sentiments, really. Let's assume that that's what people need when these terrible things have happened. Yeah. Because this is Elgar,
who
kind of conjures up a wonderful feeling of nobility, especially in this piece, doesn't he?
It is. So it's Nimrod. And every year when I hear this played, it does just make the hair stand up on the back of my neck. For me, it's about remembrance. It's about recognising those who've gone before you that have laid their lives for a better world. I have spent so much of my life working with policemen and with soldiers, and those who, when I've been in war zones, their sole purpose has been to protect us. It's about respect.
Incredibly stirring,
isn't it? It's that silence and that build to a huge crescendo and back down to silence again.
It was conducted there by Adrian Bolt, and I once sang under him, well, several times as a student, and Bolt had this wonderfully patrician look and a big moustache, and it went right out to the sides of his head, and even conducting something like that, he would be slightly twiddling the end.
Wonderful.
We heard Nimrod from the Enigma Variations by Edward Elgar, performed by the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Adrian Bolt. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is one of the world's leading forensic scientists, Professor Sue Black. Sue, you separated from your first husband in 1992, but returned to Scotland, where an old school and university friendship turned into something slightly more.
Indeed. My husband and I had been in school together, so we'd known each other since we were 17.
You and Tom had two children together, and you started working for the Foreign and Commonwealth Office and the United Nations, identifying victims in various conflict zones. And then in 1999, you got a call asking you to go to Kosovo. We should tell listeners that some of the details of the work you had to do there are really very upsetting. Were you prepared for what lay ahead?
No, not at all. I had never done anything on that scale before. And the phone call I received was from a pathologist called Peter Vanessis. And he had said to me, "Susan, what are you doing on Saturday?" And I thought he was inviting me for dinner. And he wasn't. He was already out in Kosovo. And he said, "We have a scene. I don't know how to do it, but you do." And I got on the internet to try and get myself up to speed with what was happening in the Balkans war at that time. But nothing could prepare me for that flight into Skopje in Macedonia, sitting on the borders waiting for the permission to cross with the UN. And then that breakneck travel that took us across to our first crime scene. And I can remember always being very aware of being Scottish, not a nationalist in terms of politics, but being very Scottish. And I hadn't realised I was British until I was in Kosovo. We were herring along this road at breakneck speed because there were still snipers in the hills, so we were a target. And I came around a corner and under a bridge and came right into the back of a tank. And I had never realised just how big tanks were. That horrible moment of fear, thinking, "Oh my goodness me, who is it?" And right in the corner was a little Union Jack. I can remember putting my hand on my chest thinking, "It's ours." And I'd never thought about myself as being British. Now I do. Absolutely now I do. But that for me was that moment of, "I'm safe. We've got our protectors. I'm going to be OK."
And you were confronted with some appalling things, most particularly, I suppose, that outhouse in Velika Krusha, where 44 men had been murdered.
Yes, and in February of 1999, 44 men had been taken off the refugee train and taken to this outhouse. Now, you're a man if you're 14 years of age because you can bear arms. And so the youngest person in there was a teenager and the oldest was well into his 80s or 90s. They were taken to this outhouse and they were separated into two rooms. And a gunman stood at the door of each room and just sprayed the room with Kalashnikov fire. And one of the men who'd got into the corner before anybody else, everybody effectively shielded him from the bullets. And so he lay underneath the bodies of his dead family, friends and colleagues. And the Serb militia threw in straw, they threw in petrol, they torched the building. And he knew he had to lie there while the bodies above him just burnt. The roof collapsed so that the bodies were buried underneath roof tiles. And he knew he couldn't come out. He would be shot. He had to wait until the troops had left. And we came along then in June, several months later, and you've got to bear in mind that the temperature would have been 30, 38 degrees. The bodies are very, very badly decomposed. They are commingled, so they're all in one part of the room, buried on top of each other, like a human game of Jenga. It smells very bad. And we stood at the door, two doors of that outhouse, and thought, how do you start this? And it literally is, you get down on your hands and your knees and you go forward inch by inch by inch till you find a part of a body. And then you go above it to find the ones that you have to remove first to be able to get down to ground level. It was something that I don't think anybody could ever have prepared any of us for.
And what happened to that man that was on the bottom?
He survived. He was badly burnt, but he survived, and he was one of the most important witnesses against Milosevic. But of course, Milosevic died in prison, and the man never got his chance to be a witness in court.
Does it bring you a degree of satisfaction that sometimes these war criminals are brought to The Hague, for example, or criminal court?
I don't think I'm allowed to have satisfaction. If I do the job properly, and it was a very dear friend of mine who's a retired police officer, who said, you can't become involved in this. It's not personal. You have to be a scientist, an objective scientist, recover the evidence, analyse it and present it. It's not your job to find somebody guilty. It's not your job to find somebody innocent. Somebody else will do that. You're just a cog in the process. And sometimes that's a little bit of a protective mechanism for you that says, I can't become outraged about this because I just have to do my job. It doesn't make us cold, but it does make us realistic. And it's a bit of a self-preservation, I think.
Returning home from experiences like that must be very strange. How do you stay sane? How do you separate that work from family life?
I have a clinical box inside my head. And when I go to work, I open the door and I go in and I close the door behind me. And I do what I have to do in there. And when I'm finished, I come out and I close the door again. My biggest fear is that I don't close the door properly and I get a bleed between my private life and my work life. I haven't, as far as I'm aware yet, but it could happen today. It could happen tomorrow. And we need to be prepared for it because we are just human after all.
Some people feel that Johann Sebastian Bach transcends our lives, our mortal problems. Is he somebody that you turn to?
I turn to music that reminds me of people that I respect and miss, that will bring a smile to my lips. For me, there is something in some pieces of music that are just so otherworldly that they make you move above the plane of the worst things that can happen in this world.
And this piece, Jesus, the Joy of Man's Desiring.
Back to my father again. My father would play this whilst he was practising. And as a young child, I can remember wafting down the aisle to it because it's just got this wonderful dance and flow to it. And I can remember laughing and I can remember my father laughing. And those are the moments when you're in the darkest of places in the work that we do, you find those moments of brightness. And sometimes it's just humanity. It's a woman standing beside you at a grave who has lost everything, but she will still offer you a cup of tea. That kindness, and it is a kindness.
Jesus, Christ, thy name, thy name.
Isn't the fluidity in that just delicious?
Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring by Bach, performed by the Choir of King's College, Cambridge, the Academy of St Martin in the Fields Orchestra, and conducted by David Wilcox. You were also called upon, Sue Black, to help identify victims of the 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake and the tsunami in Thailand. What particular challenges did that create?
It was in a part of the world where they hadn't expected a disaster of that magnitude ever to occur, so everybody was caught totally unprepared. And when we arrived, it was clear that with the best intentions in the world, people had gone around the beaches, the houses, and collected the dead and brought them into the cities and to the temples. There were just stacks upon stacks of bodies coming in on the back of trucks, for example. We didn't know where they'd been found. Nobody kept a record of it. Because it was beaches, people were in swimwear, so they weren't carrying any form of identification. And in that heat, bodies decompose very swiftly. And there was no crime involved here. This was a humanitarian operation, placing the bodies back with those family members who had lost them.
By this time, you were a professor at the University of Dundee and had set up the first degree in forensic anthropology. But this then expanded into a whole new centre for anatomy and human identification in 2008. Was that badly needed, do you think?
I thought it was. And I had been at a conference in Iceland with a police inspector, and I had been bemoaning the fact that when I'd been placed overseas with work for the government, frequently the students who were with me, I felt didn't have the depth and breadth of basic anatomical knowledge that they should have had. And she got so fed up with me, she eventually said, well, for goodness sake, then you have to do something about it, don't you? And I thought she was right, that I had an opportunity to bring together both anatomy and forensic anthropology under the same roof.
And you set up a campaign called A Million for a Morgue, involving some leading crime writers.
Oh, dear. There are things that you do that you think, did I really think that was a good idea at the time? And it was, in all honesty. We wanted to change the way that bodies were embalmed, because they'd always been embalmed with a horrible chemical called formalin or formaldehyde. It's a nasty chemical, and it leaves the bodies actually very rigid. And when we're training surgeons in particular, the bodies need to have greater flexibility. And we knew that there was a methodology that had been developed in Austria called teal embalming. But to be able to embalm that way, you had to create a new mortuary. You needed different pieces of equipment. And I thought, how do I raise money to build a mortuary? And somebody said, who owes you? And Val McDermott, who's the crime writer, we have known each other for many, many years. And I went to Val and I said, look, I think the kind of people who would like a mortuary named after them would be crime writers. So if you were prepared to get 9 of your friends and they were all to compete against each other to see who could raise the most money, I will name the mortuary after whoever raises the most money, knowing that Val was never going to let anybody else win. So I knew I was going to get there one way or the other.
And who was it named
after? Of course it was Val McDermott. It was always going to be Val McDermott. So it is the McDermott mortuary.
Your department was recognised with the Queen's Anniversary Prize in 2013. Did you meet the Queen?
I did. I had the great fortune of meeting her on a number of different occasions. We were really so surprised to be awarded the Queen's Award for Excellence. And it had just come at a time where one of my colleagues in my department had done a facial reconstruction of Richard III. Mm. And I just had this lovely moment where she leaned over to me very quietly and said, was he really found in a car park? And I said, yes, ma'am, he really was.
This next piece of music, Sue Black, has relevance to the late Queen, but also to your babies.
Yes, it does. It's a piece of music that was played at the Queen's funeral, played by the pipes and drums as they were taking the carriage towards Westminster. And as it was playing, my girl said, but that's our tune. And so the equivalent folk tune of it was called Hush Hush, and it was sung by the Corries, who we heard earlier. But this version, Himina Morvana, is the mist-covered mountains of home. Kosovo taught me there was nothing more important than family, because when I was out there, so many families had lost everybody. So when I came home, I always made it my mission that every night the girls had a story and they had a song. So that for them was always their song.
The Mist-Covered Mountains of Home by John Cameron, performed by the Celtic Fiddle Festival Ensemble. Sue, I can't help wondering whether, given the advice that you've given so many famous crime writers, whether you feel that science is well represented in books and on television or not.
I think it's very mixed. So a lot of the television that looks at forensic science is very fictionalised. It is there to entertain, it's not there to educate. But I have to say, the crime writers that I work with, I've always been so impressed by how much respect they have for their readers, that they want it to be as authentic as they can, because I think readers detect when it's made up.
Mendelssohn next, Sue Black, and anybody who knows anything about Mendelssohn and Scotland might know where we're going.
Oh, we're going to Fingal's Cave, aren't we? It's just, I think as you get older and older, those feelings and those sort of parts of your life that were instilled in you early on become so primitive and core that they actually get stronger the older you become. And they say the most Scottish people in the world are the expats, because when you've left Scotland, you have to hold on to something. And for me, Fingal's Cave does that. It's just got everything about the Scottish wilderness. It's got those beautiful rolling summer days. It's got those crashing waves. It is just Scotland on a plate, isn't it?
Thank you.
I kept conjuring up an image of the small Sue Black running around Scotland with total freedom as a child.
Yes, on the seashore, throwing stones and skimming them across the water. An absolutely idyllic childhood.
It does conjure up that sort of feeling, doesn't it?
Freedom, total freedom. Big skies, big water.
Fingal's Cave from The Hebrides by Felix Mendelssohn, performed by the City of Birmingham Orchestra, conducted by Edward Gardner. Cases that do involve children must be some of the most harrowing that you've had to deal with.
They are, because I don't think any of us ever expect, certainly your children, to die before you, for example. So the effect that that has on families is such a level of devastation that you could never prepare for. Sometimes, though, it's not just in death. There's a lot of work that we have done over the years in relation to identification of perpetrators of child abuse from images. And that certainly has been very harrowing.
How do you do that?
So what we have is we have images, and those images are frequently off the back of a hand because it is a touch-based crime. And when you look at the back of the hand, there's so many anatomical features on there that you can see. The vein patterns, for example, or the skin creases across your knuckles.
And presumably the work that you do, which makes people plead guilty, helps the family because it saves a lot of the trial.
So 82% of the cases we take on result in a change of plea. It means that the case doesn't have to go to court, so you save on court time, you save a lot of money. But the most important thing is that if there is a change of plea, that young person doesn't have to give evidence in court.
It's your own children's pipe band next, isn't it?
It is. So this is the Lath Allen School pipe band. Both of my girls were in the pipe band. One was a drummer and the other was the pipe major. She was out the front with the mace in the vague hope that the entire band would follow her. And she was this tiny little slip of a skinny redhead. And when you'd go to events where you'd have the big pipe bands, you'd have these enormous pipe majors, you know, who were 6'5" and built like an outhouse. And you'd have this tiny little girl alongside them. And it's a beautiful piece of music that they played so well.
But it also is important for other family reasons, your dad.
It was. My father really loved this piece of music. And unfortunately, Alzheimer's started to set in with him probably just before my mother died. And I think she probably covered up a lot of his symptoms. And so as his Alzheimer's progressed, the musician in him survived. So I would play music and I could see his fingers still on the keyboard. He'd be playing it in front of him. And right to the very end, this was the piece of music that could still stir him out of his dementia.
That must be quite a moving thing for you to hear.
Isn't it? I mean, those are school children that are playing that. Just incredible. And in the church when they would play it, you could just feel the hairs go up on the back of your neck. They're amazing.
Highland Cathedral, composed by Ulrich Röber and Michael Korb. You were talking about your father there. Do you think that in years to come, Alzheimer's will be something of the past?
I hope so, because what it does is it robs the person, but it also robs the family. So that ability to talk and to tell stories. My father was a huge storyteller, as was his mother before him. And for him to lose that ability to verbalise just must have been awful for him. But nobody can tell me that he wasn't in there and didn't understand, because we were with him the night before he died. My father had been non-communicative for about a year. And I said to him, we were all round his bed, and I said to him, Dad, I'm going away now, I'll be back in the morning. And a look of abject fear came across his face that I'd not seen an emotion on his face. And my daughter, who was with me, my oldest daughter, said, you're not going anywhere, Mum, are you? I said, no, I'm not. And he took his last breath at 3 o'clock. And once he'd taken that last breath, I knew he was gone. The body that was left was not my father. His soul had gone. And even though we felt he wasn't in there, I think we need to be careful, because maybe it's just they can't communicate it out.
Mm. Your memoir, All That Remains, A Life in Death, won the Soltar Book of the Year Award in 2018. In it, you look very pragmatically at death, characterising death as a woman, saying she's not the demon we fear, that we should choose to get to know her. We come to think of death, partially because of films and movies, as something horrendous and almost necessarily painful, but it's not always that way, is it?
No, and this comes back to my grandmother, who believed that there was another life after this one. And she always said to me as a child, death walks alongside you every step of the way, and at some point or another your paths will cross. Wouldn't it be better you made a friend out of her than an enemy? And because my grandmother grew up in the 1800s, it would have been improper for her to have a friend who was a man. And so therefore death was a woman. And somehow that feels softer. It feels less threatening. And death at times can be just such a healing mechanism of itself.
Why do you think we are so reluctant to ask questions, to face up to something which is a natural part of the cycle of life?
It's inevitable. And I think we used to have a much healthier respect for death in the past. If you think Granny, when she died, used to be laid out in the coffin in your front room and people would come around and tell stories. That part of death was always accepted. But I think our dying and our death has become quite medicalised, and it's become quite impersonal. Almost the minute you die, the body's taken away and it's never seen again.
Will you leave your body to medical science?
Have done so. I've requested, if possible, that when my time comes, I'm dissected by science students and not medics or dentists, because the science students learn much more anatomy. And I feel that they will get down to almost every single part of me, because I literally want every part explored. And then what I'd really love, and I don't know that they'll be able to do it, but you never know, I quite like the bones to be retained. And if they could boil them down to get rid of the fat, because it's the only way to do that, then I could become a teaching skeleton. And the possibility of teaching for the rest of my death really appeals to my Scottish Presbyterian thing of, you know, working hard.
And do you have a religious belief in an afterlife?
No, I believe this is our life. Mm. I do hold very strongly to Christian principles of doing right and not doing wrong, of being the best that I can. But I have a real difficulty of believing that there is something beyond here. I've spent my life with the dead, and they don't spook me, the living do.
We're going to end happily, I'm going to say, where we began, because we're ending with Handel. And this is the arrival of the Queen of Sheba, but I should have said really the departure of the Queen of Forensic Anatomy. Does it promote the same kind of feelings that the music we had at the beginning?
It does. It does so many things for me, because my father always played Handel. Handel was clearly in his bones. And when I was getting married, I sat down with my father and said, right, what music are we going to have? And he said, well, you have to have Handel. You have to arrive as the Queen of Sheba. And so I remember walking down the aisle on my father's arm. He looked magnificent in grey top hat and tails. It was just the proudest moment of my life.
Well, it only remains in that case for me to say, Sue Black, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Arrival of the Queen of Sheba by George Friedrich Handel, performed by Jeremy Filsell on the organ of Lansing College Chapel. The final choice today of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the forensic scientist Professor Sue Black. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. And next week, Michael will be chatting to the writer Satnam Sangera. In a few moments, Sarah Moore-Peach is here with a playlist to illuminate Mendelssohn's influential Hebrides Overture.
New sounds this spring on BBC Radio 3.
Exclusive recordings from all over the world with Classical Live, weekday afternoons from 1.
Join us for an incredible mix of live and recorded performance, including chamber music from Wigmore Hall.
Unique performances you won't hear anywhere else. Classical Live, weekday afternoons from 1.
Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
And a very warm welcome from me, Al Ryan. If you just joined us, it's 1:30 and our afternoon continues now on Radio 3 with Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map. Today's destination is out at sea. You can hear the swell of waves, the salt spray of the Atlantic. We're on a small boat heading towards the lonely Hebridean island of Staffa, with its gaping cave entrance of slant basalt. This is Felix Mendelssohn's Hebrides Overture, also known as Fingal's Cave. And these are the pipes and drums of the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders playing a lament called Fingal's Weeping. I'm Sarah Moore-Peach and this is Music Map, a new Sunday afternoon listening journey where we locate a particular piece of music not with our minds but with our ears, creating a sort of sonic Venn diagram. And today, we're charting a path towards Mendelssohn's Hebrides Overture, which we'll hear in full at the end of the show. Mendelssohn was by no means the only musician captivated by the legend of the bard Fingal, and also by the uninhabited island of Staffa, and we'll hear a few of those today. But let's start with another piece that Mendelssohn himself wrote, inspired by Scotland. ¶¶